Pushkin.
Did you know some travel credit cards offer 10 times points on your spending? Don't miss out on big rewards for your next trip. NerdWallet lets you compare smart travel credit cards side by side, curated by an expert team of finance nerds. What could future you do with better travel rewards? A free flight? A room upgrade? Don't wait to make smart financial decisions. Compare and find smarter credit cards, savings accounts, and more today at nerdwallet.com. Reminder, credit is subject to lender approval and terms apply. NerdWallet, finance smarter.
The most innovative companies are going further with T-Mobile for Business. The PGA of America is helping lower scores and elevate fan experiences with AI coaching tools and 5G connected cameras. AAA is getting more drivers back on the road fast with location telematics. And the Las Vegas Grand Prix is powering race day operations with 5G connectivity, giving fans an experience at the speed they deserve. This is accelerating innovation with T-Mobile for Business. Take your business further at T-Mobile.com/now.
I'm David Remnick, and each week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, my colleagues and I unpack what's happening in a very complicated world. You'll hear from the New Yorker's award-winning reporters and thinkers, Jelani Cobb on race and justice, Jill Lepore on American history, Vincent Cunningham and Gia Tolentino on culture, Bill McKibben on climate change, and many more. To get the context behind events in the news, listen to the New Yorker Radio Hour wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Talk Easy. I'm Sam Fragoso. Welcome to the show. Today, I'm joined by writer, actor, and director, Bill Hader. In 2013, Hader stepped away from Saturday Night Live after 8 years as a performer. It was a tough decision, but one he had to make if he was ever going to do the thing he always wanted to do, which was to write and direct movies. Growing up in Tulsa, Oklahoma, he spent his childhood in video stores and movie theaters, enthralled by the DIY spirit of filmmakers like Steven Soderbergh and Spike Lee. At home, when he was supposed to be sleeping, his father would come into his bedroom and say, Bill, your mom would probably get upset about this, but why don't we go downstairs and watch Monty Python? And so they did. And that dream of making movies, which was cultivated as Bill came of age in the 80s and 90s, was put on hold until 2018. It was then that Hader, with the help of Alec Berg, created Barry. The Emmy award-winning show is about a former Marine turned hitman who hopes to one day become an actor in Hollywood. It's recently returned for a new season on HBO. Here's a clip from the trailer.
We've both done terrible things in our lives, but everybody deserves a second chance. I believe that you can be the version of yourself that you want to be.
I need a purpose.
Forgiveness is something that has to be earned. It's like that line in Shawshank Redemption. Get rich or die trying.
If I don't do this, I don't live! I have to do this to live!
When I met Mr. Cousineau, I was a lost soul.
He left here on my own.
He didn't just teach me how to be a better actor. He taught me how to be a human being.
To face hell.
He saved my life.
All alone.
You look good.
So do you.
That was from season 3 of Barry. You can watch new episodes of the show every Sunday night on HBO. Now, quick warning here. For those of you listening to this on Sunday, May 1st, Bill and I do discuss one scene in episode 2 of season 3, which airs later tonight. It's not a huge spoiler, but it happens around the 6-minute mark in case you want to skip that. Beyond Barry, We discuss growing up in Tulsa, Oklahoma, the influence of his late grandfather, moving to Los Angeles in his early 20s, becoming a cast member on SNL at 27, working through anxiety, and how, eventually, after a few detours, he found his way to Barry. I hope you enjoyed this special episode with the one and only Bill Hader. Bill Hader, nice to meet you.
Hi.
You're in the process of finishing Barry as we speak, right?
Yeah. Yeah, we have to mix episodes 7 and 8.
When you watch the first cut of any episode, you've said that you have a full-on mental breakdown.
Yeah, that's true.
Did that happen again putting together this season?
Yes. I can set my watch to it. I go in with the editor. I sit. They start it, and then I have to see myself, I have to hear my voice, and then all the cool things I wanted to do are not really there.
How quickly do you make that realization?
It's like just you feel it. It's instinctual. The minute it starts, you're just like, this is wrong. This whole thing is wrong. I don't know what I was thinking. And then it's just this long process of getting it back to what you initially hoped it would be. And it gets there, and then some ways it changes. Things change in a way that help it.
It's sort of a gradual acceptance of your own inadequacies.
Yeah, yeah. That you're mediocre, and you have a weird sounding voice, and I look more and more like my dad with each season, you know what
I mean? Is that a problem?
Yes. No offense, Dad.
You share the same name, too.
Yeah. I'm a junior. So I just don't want people to like think that my dad got a show.
Because it would just inflate his ego too much.
Yeah, even more than it actually is. Right. I mean, he'll be going crazy. No, my dad's a very sweet guy.
So eventually you've come to terms with this new season. Are you feeling marginally better now?
Yeah, now that it's coming out and I'm getting like nice responses from people. But mostly, you know, you do it to make the thing. So it's like in the making of the thing is where it's at. So for me, it's when we sit in the mixing stage, which is the kind of last stage in the whole process. And you sit back and watch it and go, you know what? This came out all right.
When it comes to the actual show itself, it picks up, I think, 6 months after season two.
That's right. Yeah.
You've said that season one was about hope against an obstacle, Barry trying to get in touch with his emotions. Season two is about whether we can change our nature. Barry is a violent person, but can he leave that rage behind him? How would you describe the crux of season three?
There's a lot of different things kind of happening in season three, but one is this idea of forgiveness and redemption, and forgiveness being earned. It has to be earned, as Noah Hanks says in the first episode. But then this idea, is it actually like a thing? Like, is that possible? And can you forgive yourself?
Do you think it is?
I don't know. That's why we write the show. We ask ourselves these questions. And then the kind of cycle of things that I find really interesting. Like there are things, as we were writing it, everyone's stories start to kind of parallel each other in an interesting way. But I would say forgiveness being earned, ellipses, if it is indeed a thing.
To be determined.
Yeah. We're still figuring it out.
Well, you know, George Saunders, who we were talking about before, likes to say that your job as a writer is to present the question, not...
Yeah, that checkoff thing is like you present the problem, not the answer. That's true. And I'm a big proponent of that. You know, there's something in episode two that kind of... There was a scene where Barry wants Sally, his girlfriend, to put Cousineau on her show. And she's like, I can't, you know, he's an asshole. Like no one wants to work with him, you know.
Has a horrible reputation.
He has a terrible reputation. And Barry... His back's really against the wall, and it was only a matter of time before his rage issues come out, and he flips out on his girlfriend, puts her back up against the wall, gets in her face and screams at her, and then leaves. Now, what we shot initially was that happens, and then you see Sally on the set of her show, and then she is texting, and she has kind of like another, not necessarily a fight, but she's texting Barry. and saying, "Are you okay? Was it? Were you sad? Or you know?" Whatever. And then he's kind of re-triggered this kind of thing for her that she was in an abusive relationship, and she's gone back and like kind of regressed into this kind of placating thing. And Elsie Fisher, who plays her co-star, sees the texts. We wrote that and then showed it to some people, and everybody in the, you know, said, well, something would happen. Because, I mean, he really flips out at her, and people are seeing it. Like, no one would say anything, you know? And someone's like, yeah. Someone would say something. What needs to happen to him is he needs to be reprimanded. She needs to file a report against him and blah, blah, blah. And then someone else said, but he doesn't, you know, these are the writers. These aren't, I'm not at Chick-fil-A. These are like, just talking. But, and then another writer was like, but he doesn't touch her. He doesn't throw anything. He doesn't really threaten her. He just gets angry.
No crime has been committed.
No crime has been committed. And then someone's like, well, they can't really call HR because he doesn't work there. And then as that was happening, I realized, oh, this is the scene. This is the scene we need.
It wrote itself.
Yes. And it was that thing where you just kind of say like, oh, this is it. You pose it and go, well, what would actually happen, and just show the problem. Mm-hmm. And so we went back and reshot it.
Throughout this season, but especially in these first two episodes, there is a thematic and aesthetic connection to Goodfellas in a way, in part because we're seeing Barry lash out at people that he loves, which of course reminds me of an hour and a half into Goodfellas.
I mean, it wasn't like consciously was like, oh, let's do Goodfellas, but you know, you watch something 20 times over 30 years or something, it becomes ingrained in you. You know, it wasn't until I was mixing the last episode of season two that I was like, oh my God, this is Taxi Driver. You know, we're doing Taxi Driver. This is embarrassing.
Was that a good realization?
Yeah. I mean, everybody has those things. Like I've said that to other filmmakers and they're like, well, everything is that, you know, like Scorsese's doing Godard and Fassbender and you're, mm-hmm. you know what I mean? And all these other things. But no, it wasn't conscious, but I think the Coppa Warner and Goodfellas is a great example of a Warner that actually tells a story. Some Warners that you see, they don't need to be a Warner. You go, why does this all need to be one shot? And so that one, I was like, oh, well, the one in episode one, it's Sally's character entering the set of her show and everything that's expected of her. And it was very kind of autobiographical because it's how I feel on the set of Barry. And I just thought, well, how can I do this emotionally? When I come on a set, I always feel very small. The actual stage is massive, and then the sets are tall. And so I was like, oh, I want to start very wide. And so she looks very small coming onto the set, and then we slowly start to move in on her. We're dollying with her, and then you end in a very tight profile of her. So going from this very objective point of view to this kind of subjective thing. And that I know, not consciously, is like, oh, it's a Coppa shot. But then when I watched it, I was like, oh, that's very much me watching Goodfellas all the time since whenever it came out. I was 12 when that movie came out, and being like, that tells a story, you know?
When you're 10, you watch Taxi Driver with your father, right?
I watched it at a kid's sleepover.
At a kid's sleepover.
Yeah, older brother tried to blow the younger kid's mind. 16-year-old brother came in and was like, all right, dude, here's what y'all are going to watch. You know, I grew up in Oklahoma. All right, guys, shut up. Here we go. Taxi Driver and Clockwork Orange, same night.
Double feature. Is it true that you haven't slept actually from that day on?
Yeah, then people are going, you have anxiety? But it was like a double mind blower kind of thing.
You said at that time, at age 10, you were sporting a disgusting rat tail of a haircut.
Yes. I think I probably thought I had long hair. I think in my head, I looked like Jimmy Page or something, but I didn't. I looked like a disgusting child.
Seems a little harsh on yourself.
No, you haven't seen the pictures. I mean, it's very heavy metal parking lot, you know? It's not good. And it's a baseball pitcher. There's one where I'm like, my baseball little league pitcher, if you saw it, you were like, well, that was taken in 1987 or whatever it was, 88.
But that version of you, that 10-year-old self watching Taxi Driver, wasn't it there that you made some sort of connection that someone is directing this movie.
Yeah. Yeah. The first shot was a Travis Bickle shot, him on the phone.
This scene gives me great anxiety.
Yeah. He takes Cybill Shepherd to a porn movie. Just talking about it's making me nervous. And then she leaves and it's really embarrassing. And you could see it as like he's purposely doing it to sabotage the date or whatever he's doing. And then he calls her. He sent her flowers and she hasn't called him back. So he calls her to be like, hey, did you get my flowers? And he's on a payphone. And as he's talking to her, it's so hard to watch. The camera then just dollies off of him, dollies down the wall and lines up like on a hallway. And I thought, oh, the movie doesn't want to watch this. You can do that. You can have kind of a subjective, emotional camera. That movie does it. I mean, you know, when Travis Bickle shoots Harvey Keitel in the doorway, that's another scene because the way it's framed is from the point of view of someone sitting on a stoop across the street. So we, the audience, are just sitting on a stoop across the street and we're watching two guys argue and one guy shoots the other guy. And then Scorsese just stays there and you just watch Travis Bickle and then he sits down. So now it's just us and Travis Bickle. And in the background, it's brilliant. There's a TV on. Mm-hmm. Like you're seeing an apartment behind him and there's a TV on in the background. So you just get this sense that life is being led around you and this violence is taking place while everybody else is just going about their day. And it just affected me in a massive, massive way.
Throughout your teenage years, you become increasingly obsessed with movies. You spend time at a place called Sound Warehouse in the video section, I think, endlessly nagging clerks about 8 and a half and when it's going to be there. You weren't an especially gifted student. Your French teacher described you in such a way. Do you remember what she said?
She said, Guillaume is very...
Is that you?
Yeah, that's me, William Guillaume. I think I'm saying it right, but I'm terrible at French. But it's very funny. One day, maybe he'll be on Saturday Night Live. He has a 43 in his class.
He will not be speaking French.
He will not be speaking French on Saturday Night Live. So I was like a fuck up, but it wasn't like, you know, I think everybody thought I was probably on drugs, but I was actually the opposite. I wasn't drinking or doing drugs. I was just weird.
So you didn't even have an excuse.
I didn't have an excuse. I remember like the cool English teacher, like the guy who was like Donald Sutherland in Animal House, you know, that kind of guy. Mm-hmm. And I remember he was talking to some stoner kids and I heard him. He goes, what? No way. And he yelled across the classroom, Hater, you don't smoke the Dubage?
That didn't inspire you to try?
It just makes me tired. I just get like tired. Anything, even drinking, I just get kind of smiley. I just smile a lot and I'm like, oh, that's fun. I look like I'm fun when I'm drunk, but I'm not.
At 17, you are, I think, like in the throes of loving movies and spending most of your time watching them instead of doing classwork.
Anything, yeah.
It's around that time that I believe your grandfather passes away.
That's right, yeah.
His name was Jack Patton.
Jack Patton, yeah.
He lived down the street from you. Uh-huh. He passed away of pancreatic cancer.
Yeah.
You said when he died, that was a massive turning point in my life. It was my first traumatic realization that this all ends, and it instilled in me some impulse to push past my fears and inhibitions and try to go to be a filmmaker.
Yeah, that's true. Again, on this, like, subconscious level.
Right.
It wasn't the thing that you know, see in the movies where it's like
the light bulb happens.
Yeah, it's me looking at the ocean because there was no ocean in Oklahoma. So I'd be looking at a pond. But it was this kind of weird feeling of finite. Everything's going to end at some point.
Ephemeral.
That's what I meant to say. And yeah, there's nothing you can do about that. He actually got it the way that you would hope to, which was he was surrounded by, you know, all his loved ones. And it's the way we all hope to go, you know? And so that was just something that, lack of a better word, a confidence kind of kicked in of, okay, I'm going to do this. I'm going to figure out how to do this. And so then I was like, I'm going to Arizona. Again, I'm not smart. I just went, I'm going to go to Arizona. And then
headline from this podcast, Bill Hader, not smart,
not bright. No, I went to Arizona as Jimmy Kimmel went, wait, you went out of state to go to community college? And I was like, yeah, yes, I did. Well, one was Art Institute of Phoenix. It was like a trade school. And then a kid there said, Scottsdale Community College, they actually have an Airy BL. And I went, oh, wow. And they have a couple of Arri-S's and they had like film cameras and they had Avids. And this is in 1997. So I just thought, holy shit, I got to get my hands on that because digital wasn't what it is today. And so I went there, enrolled, immediately spent like $3,000 on a short film that I never finished.
Was that The Wan by Nick Jasenovic?
Oh, no. He's The Wan by Nick Jasenovic I acted in.
He's The Wan.
Nick Jasenovic. Do you know Nick?
We play basketball every Sunday.
Oh, yeah. Nick, he's The Wan. That's Nick's movie. It was a movie that was just bad. And then I moved to Los Angeles. Nick was there. A guy named Justin Carlton, a guy named John Humber. And we just started PAing.
So you're PAing across a bunch of different kinds of film sets, some big, some small. I think you find a lot of this work on the back page of The Hollywood Reporter.
Yeah.
One of the first jobs you have is on a film called Final Payback.
Yes, with Richard Grieco.
What was your job on that movie?
So there's a guy named John Saxon. Do you know who he is?
No.
Okay, so John Saxon, he's the sheriff in Nightmare on Elm Street. He was in Enter the Dragon. He's in a great, very bad movie called Mitchell. I was a big John Saxon fan, and I got to run lines with him. So I got to sit there as a PA, and I thought I had made it because I was just being like, sir, your wife is dead. And he was like, what do you mean she is dead? What are you saying? You know, and I was like, sir, I don't know what to tell you. And I was like, this is the coolest thing ever. And I think it was a scene where he pulls up in a really nice car and hops out and they go, so your wife's been murdered. And he's like, no, you know, and so I got to run lines with him. And then I had to back the car up. It's like a super nice Rolls Royce that the producer owned. And I went, okay. And I had to back it up. He drives up like a super windy driveway. So I just would sit and just very slowly back this thing up. I would just start to hit something and like it would be like, whoop, and now I just hear John Saxon go, no.
It went on like this for a few years, doing all these kinds of jobs.
Yes, I did that. I was on, me and Nick Jasenovic worked on a kids movie called Two Little Heroes. There was a stunt coordinator on there named Solly Marks that Nick and I were just obsessed with, and we would talk to him a lot. He like, I think he was from Russia and he like smoked a pipe and he was the stunt coordinator, but he looked like an academic kind
of. These experiences, at some point, you reach the end of the road and you don't want to PA anymore. You start working as an assistant editor at places and then doing all this work. Eventually, you start performing at Second City Los Angeles. From there, Megan Mullally comes to watch Matt Offerman, loves your performance, says, I'm going to call Lorne Michaels. When you get the call to go audition, do you remember that day?
So I was in a edit bay. It was a company called Triage, and I was working on Iron Chef America, and a editor had come in frustrated because I had put his project together wrong. As the assistant editor, you stay up all night and you're kind of prepping what that editor has to do the next day. And as he was talking to me, I saw a phone call, a number from I didn't recognize. It was Megan Mullally, and she said, hey, it's Megan. And she said, I told Lorne Michaels about you, and he'd like to meet you. I hope that's okay. And I don't really know what she said after that. I kind of just, well, and then there was a line on the, someone beeping in on the other line, and I was like, hello? And it was like, hi, my name is Lindsay Shookus. I work at the talent department at SNL, and Lorne Michaels would like to meet you. Who do I call? Like, who's your manager? And I was like, I don't have a manager. She's like, well, he'd like to meet you. Can you fly out next week? And it was a whirlwind.
The night of your audition, it happens, I think, a few weeks later at the UCB on 26th Street in New York.
Yeah, well, we had done a show in LA first.
Right, but you had packed it with all your friends.
And he was like, this is all your friends. Jasenovic was at that show, actually. He was cheering really loud, and then it was
you
like,
gotta sell the bits.
Yeah, it was like, he was like, oh, these are all his friends. So now you got to come to New York and do it for a New York crowd.
Mm-hmm.
And in the front row was Seth Meyers, Tina Fey, Amy Poehler, Mike Shoemaker, Lorne Michaels, Marcy Klein. Terrifying. But you know what? At the time, though, I had nothing to lose. And my sister flew out from Oklahoma, so I just remember like hanging with her and like the guys in the sketch group I was in, Matt Offerman and Mel Cowan and Eric Filipkowski, and what's going to happen? Like, well, this is something I'll tell my grandkids, you know?
Lauren said that one of the impressions that pushed you over the edge was of Peter Falk.
What the heck was the bit? He does do a thing where he says,
This is a Jawa. Now listen over here, look at me. What we're going to do here is we're going to play a Jawa. These are from the sand, the Tatooine, okay?
I mean, that kind of show was kind of like where I was at that time. It was real nerd humor. Stuff now that would drive me crazy. Where I'm like, oh, stop it with the Star Wars refs. Yeah.
Well, your tastes change.
Yeah, you become like a withering snob.
Is that how you describe yourself now?
Yeah, that's my license plate. Yeah.
Withering snob? They put that all on there.
Yeah, they put it all on there. I have two license plates, actually. Just stuck them together.
On SNL, once you're on the show in 2005, you said that there's this thing with funny people where you think that if you're not good at this, you're not good at anything. So with SNL, I was like, if this doesn't work, I'm fucked. Because I'm bad at everything else.
That is kind of true. It was like the only two things I, growing up, that I had confidence in was I'm funny and I really think I can make a movie. I really think I could be a good director.
You said that to your father after a basketball game?
Yes, after a basketball game. I said, Dad, I think the only two things I'm good at are this. And it was in reference to I suck at basketball. So it was like, I can make a movie. And I'm funny. That's it. Everything else, like, don't count on me. And then the funny thing is it never really changed. You know, when you get to SNL and your whole worth, do you know what I mean, is being funny. You get there and then you're doing stuff and it's not funny. And then you can get in your head and then go, oh my God, maybe I'm not good at this stuff. I'm not funny, you know?
Did you feel like that in the early days where you didn't think you were funny?
Yes. And a lot of that was just getting confidence and kind of realizing like, oh, everybody has ups and downs. And it was kind of helpful for me to see people that I did find funny, like Fred Armisen or Will Forte bomb, you know, or you would see Steve Martin come back and host and do a thing that didn't work and go, huh. And so I got to study that and go, okay, this is just part of the process is failing. And then it became a little easier. I think I just got to a place where I go, well, so how do I alleviate my anxiety here? And I was like, oh, you know what? Like, I could just make it where, what are the things I can control? What I can control are bring two good pieces to the table read every Wednesday, and I'm good in everybody else's sketches. And that's it. And then it was just kind of like, whatever people put me in, I would just do the best job I could.
This anxiety you've mentioned a few times, it's, as you've said, pervasive in those SNL years. And I have to say, there's such a stunning disconnect between the joy you're bringing people at home versus the kind of pain it seemed to be causing you.
You know, a lot of it's like the anticipation of it, the anticipation of going out, the anticipation of 5 minutes to air. I just would go to the place where I'm like, I'm going to pass out. But the whole week, that clock starts. So starting Monday, when I walk in, I would always have this feeling like, okay, the clock started. And getting you to that point where you're on air on Saturday. And it was just the first four seasons, especially, was just crippling. It was really hard. I can see it in some of my performances where I put my hand in front of my face or I will grab onto things. It's like I'm literally trying to hide or steady myself. Vanessa Bayer and I just were talking and we talked about a time where we were in a sketch and I grab onto her arm midway through the sketch. And she kind of was like, oh, why are you doing this? And then she kind of looked at me and saw in my eyes that I was
going through it.
Yeah, going through it. And just like, we just went through the thing. And then after at good nights when, you know, we're all waving goodbye and stuff, we hugged. She said, hey, are you okay? And I was like, oh, no, sorry about that. You know, I just had a moment. I think as the show went on and everything, I got a little bit better with it. But Julian Assange cold open. I mean, if you watch that, I can tell I'm trying to hide myself into this wine glass that they gave me because that cold open was given to me like that day. And Seth Meyers, it was a thing. You would show up and Seth Meyers would go, hey, you're Julian Assange in the cold open. And I would just full on spin out. The thing that would calm me down is just read it over and over and over again to the point where I really get it and I would know what I was supposed to do and I would get the rhythms right and everything. And then between dress and air, they change it all. So yeah, I just would have a panic attack.
They were torturing you.
Yeah, but you know what? I think that's to everybody else is that they just saw me being dramatic or, you know, Colin Jost, if he had to make changes to a sketch before air, I would be following him around being like, okay, just give them to me the minute they get out of the copier. And he'd be like, will you please relax? You know,
you said I'd wake up Saturday morning crying, hitting my head against the shower, saying, I don't want to go. I don't want to go. That does sound like a kid who doesn't want to go to school.
Yeah, yeah, it's that feeling, yeah. And I had that, you know. I remember being a kid and just being very, the social anxiety of walking into school and it being very big, and especially when I got into like sixth grade and you're around like freshmen in high school and people like that, you know, walking around, it was all very intimidating. So it was like, oh, this would be so much better if I didn't have to go. And yeah, yeah, I would get really worked up. And Maggie Carey would come down, who I was married to at the time, would come down and calm me down. And it was, you know, very lovely of her. And, you know, she would do like breathing that she had learned in like Lamaze type breathing stuff, you know, to try to calm my nerves down. And it was really sweet. But yeah, man, it was rough. It was a rough go.
It seemed like one person that made it a little bit easier, in addition to Maggie, was John Mulaney coming on the show.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, 100%.
Now, usually in interviews, people want to replay and talk about all these sketches and characters you've done. The truth is, SNL is extremely litigious, and there's no chance we're going to be able to get that clip. So there is one sketch that I'd like to have on record because it's so good, and it never made the air. It's a samurai film. Directed by James L. Brooks.
And John and I wrote it.
The title was called But What If You're Wrong?
Yeah, But What If You're Wrong? It's like a samurai film, and you see them fighting, and it's like honor, you know, family, blah, blah, blah. They're fighting, and it's like dating after 40. And it was me and Fred as two guys, and it was like, gave her the keys to my house. Now I have a Netflix subscription. And then like really violent fighting. And then that song, Walking on Sunshine, kicks in. And then it was us as samurais. But it was all like, look, in the Book of Life, I just want to be in the acknowledgments. Yeah, I think Abby Elliott and Nassim Bedrad were two geishas, but speed walking in Central Park. And then one of them like runs into a light pole and goes like, whoa, and falls down.
When you pitched this to Lorne Michaels, do you remember what he said?
No.
He said, samurais, James L. Brooks, I don't understand.
Well, we always liked James L. Brooks, and I think in a Stefan, we put in a club was written and directed by James L. Brooks.
He probably sounded different than I just did.
Yeah, no. I like this, but why now? But yeah, that was one we wrote. We also wrote one that was like, we did a Mr. Belvedere sketch because there's like a Belvedere, you know, there's like the thing where the guy played Mr. Belvedere at a table read, sat on his balls and had to go to the hospital. So we did that scene. It was me playing Mr. Belvedere and I was standing up. And then I was like, I just want to say before I sit down how much I love all of you. And being on the show is just one of the greatest delights of my life. And I want you all to know that I just love you. And then I start to sit down. And right before I sit down, I go, another thing real quick. I just want you to know that these scripts are some of the most fantastic scripts I've ever seen in my life.
It's almost a little Alan Alda-like.
Yeah, yeah. And then like the thing was that it was Urban Legend Theater. And it was Mick Jagger playing himself, hosting Urban Legend Theater. So he's like, I'm Mick Jagger. And then he says, it's called, so when you sit on your balls, it's called pulling a Belvedere. And then Will Forte gave us our final line because we were like, yeah, we don't know how to end this sketch. He goes, oh, you should have him sit down and not scream or anything. Just sit down and stare for a bit and then go, I just myselfed myself. Yeah, that didn't make it on either. It was just kind of like, guys, come on. It was like, come on, that's hilarious. No,
you know, it didn't make it on SNL, but it made it here. On here.
It made it on here, and I think John will be happy that it's out there, the Mr. Belvedere
John
sketch.
John will be happy it's on Talk Easy.
Talk Easy, now he knows Mr. Belvedere sketch, which no one found funny.
Look, I liked it. I liked it.
Oh, thanks.
We'll be right back after a quick break.
As listeners to this show, you probably consider yourself pretty smart. But how smart is your wallet? When you're looking to upgrade your wallet, it's time to turn to NerdWallet. Their expert team of nerds has the financial smarts to help you find the right financial products for you. Before NerdWallet, you might have paid for vacations with whatever was in your wallet. But you could have been missing out on miles you didn't even know you were leaving on the table. Now you can get a new card with more miles and more upgrades. What could future you do with more travel rewards? A hotel upgrade? Lounge access? Wherever you go next, make it happen with a smarter travel card. Don't wait to make smart financial decisions. Compare and find smarter credit cards, savings accounts, and more today at nerdwallet.com. NerdWallet. Finance smarter. As with all cards, credit is subject to lender approval and terms apply.
When you drive a vehicle so reliable it's backed by a 10-year, 100,000-mile limited warranty, you stop thinking about what you can't do and start doing what you never thought possible. Visit your local Kia dealer today to see what you're capable of in a vehicle that inspires confidence around every corner. Kia. Movement that inspires.
Call 800-333-4KIA for details. Always drive safely. Limited inventory available. Warranties include 10-year, 100,000-mile powertrain and 5-year, 60,000-mile basic. Warranties are limited. See retailer for details.
I'm David Remnick, and each week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, my colleagues and I unpack what's happening in a very complicated world. You'll hear from the New Yorker's award-winning reporters and thinkers, Jelani Cobb on race and justice, Jill Lepore on American history, Vincent Cunningham and Gia Tolentino on culture, Bill McKibben on climate change, and many more. To get the context behind events in the news, listen to the New Yorker Radio Hour wherever you get your podcasts.
You know, we were talking about that Julian Assange cold open. We are clearly having a panic attack. And I'll say, I rewatched it. There's something happening.
Yeah.
If I didn't know to look for it, I wouldn't have known. But that night, I think it's December 10th of 2010, Jeff Bridges is hosting.
Yeah.
Jeff Bridges gives you some advice that night that seems like you listen to and carry with you into
yeah,
the next chapter.
Yeah, it was huge. Yeah. And I got a chance to tell him this on the red carpet at the Golden Globes. I saw him and went over and said, "Hey, man, you said this to me." And he was like, "I said what?" You know, and I said, "You said," he said, "you know, I worked with Robert Ryan, and Robert Ryan, before every take, would start sweating." And I said, "Wow, after all these years, you still get afraid." And he said, "Oh, I'd be really afraid if I wasn't afraid." And he was like, "That fear, like, that's your buddy. That's your friend. Like, you take that with you and don't push it away. When you push it, it makes it worse, you know?" And that really hit me, and it was very gracious, and I just, that was huge.
I can hear Jeff Bridges saying, "It's your buddy."
Yeah.
"It's your buddy, man." Could you imagine?
That's what he would say on it.
You take that advice, eventually leaving SNL after 8 years in 2013. You take that nervousness and channel it into your work moving forward. You're great in this film called Skeleton Twins immediately after that. There's another film called Trainwreck.
Don't worry. Hey, man, it's all right. It's okay. No,
it's
okay.
Jeff Bridges,
hey,
to me.
Hey, buddy. Hey, you can do it. It's okay. It's Trainwreck, but you can call it whatever you want, man.
I think I said Twainwreck.
Twainwreck, because I'm a little boy. Because I'm a scared little boy. It's Twainwreck.
I'm terrified.
This is Talk Easy. All right.
Anything else?
No. That was fun. I'm done.
Bill's like, "I'm so glad you finally messed up."
"Oh, thank God he screwed up. Now I have the upper hand. Who has all the status in here now?"
I was throwing a perfect game.
Yeah.
You know, you make these films. Eventually, you and Alec Berg talk about making a show for HBO. Do you remember those early conversations you had about making Barry?
Well, initially, we were talking about making another show.
About Tulsa, Oklahoma.
About Tulsa, Oklahoma, and a guy I grew up with, and I was going to play that guy. And then it just, you know, we had the first episode lined out, and then after that, I was like, this really doesn't go anywhere. And I'll admit, Breaking Bad had just ended, and I don't watch a lot of television. I tend to just watch a lot of movies, and I read, which you'd never guess from hearing me speak. But you
what
know.
Was your license plate again?
withering babies. No, wait, what was it? Withering dumbass. What?
I think snob?
Withering snob. Hello, we're Withering Snob. We're from Sacramento. And
that was actually a Philip Roth novel.
It's called Withering Snob. Yeah, so I liked Breaking Bad, and I was talking to Alec. I was like, you know, it'd be good to have something that has, like, stakes to it and that moves and has, like, a narrative propulsion to it. And I also read, like, comic books, but not, like, not necessarily, you know, like these DC Vertigo books. And their stuff would have, like, some depth to it, but also it moved. Like, what, you know, I want to do something like that. And we were at S&W Diner in Culver City, and I said, what if I was a hitman? And he said, I hate hitmen, like the skinny tie, two Glocks in their hand. I just, that's lame. I don't want to do that. And I was like, no, it'll be me, just me. And then we start talking, and I still to this day don't know how, but we said, what if he takes an acting class? But I do remember Alex saying, hitman taking an acting class is kind of cool. He's like, that's a show. And I think the reason was it was like, the juxtaposition of the two things, living in the shadows versus living in the spotlight. It was like, oh, this is really helpful. And so we just started talking it out. And then, you know, our first drafts of it were like, the acting world was great, but the hitman world, we tried to, it was more inspired by movies.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was like the hitmen were all at a barbecue together and like all this stuff. And then Amy Gravitt and Casey Bloys at HBO read it, and their note was like, the acting world seems great. Hitman world, like, I don't know what this is. And they were right. And then that was when I was like, well, what if he's a Marine? And then suddenly that just brought it all into place.
Alex said, part of what I was interested in with Barry was this idea of having a gif that you hated. Bill was like that on SNL, so suddenly the story was personal.
Yes. Not that I hated it, but it was also like this gif to be able to be funny, like I told my dad in the car, you know, and do voices and stuff. But then having to go on Saturday Night Live on live television, which was like really physically hurting me. You know, I have like autoimmune problems. I have all types of stuff that I have to kind of deal with. And when I talk to people, they're like, were you ever under a lot of stress? And I was like, yes, I was. Again, I did it and I got through it. And I never want anybody to think I'm blaming the show or something. It was just my chemical, the way I'm made up. It's just who I am. So it was like, oh, what if it's like a guy who's really good at killing people? That's like his gift. And then he just wants to make a better life for himself.
There was that personal.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you got to be able to, that's why I learned is writing forever. I would write so much, just, I'd write full screenplays, and then you back up and you're like, oh, this is just about other movies, or this is like movie logic. Not like it's like completely ripping off a thing, but it's like, oh, I got really inspired and I wrote this thing and it's got cool sequences in it, but the emotion wasn't anything personal that I could really latch on to and write from. So that's what Barry was the first thing I really started to do that with.
Well, it completely comes through because at the end of the pilot, there's a scene between you and Henry Winkler. He's in his Escalade and
yeah.
You walk up to him and ask, should I be in this class? Do you think I'm good enough to be in this class?
Yeah.
But the point of this scene, while watching it at home, your sister Cara saw it. She said, I couldn't believe that Bill was finally showing himself, finally being vulnerable to being denied and having his heart broken. I was almost brokenhearted watching it. Why don't we take a look at that scene for a second? This is from the pilot episode of Barry.
What you did was dog shit. I mean, really, really awful. Dumb acting, I call it. Do you know why? Because acting is truth, and I saw no truth. So here's my advice to you. You go back to whatever nook of the world you call home, and you do whatever it is you're good at, because this is not it.
You want to know what I'm good at? I'm good at killing people. Yeah, when I got back from Afghanistan, I was really depressed, you know, like I didn't leave my house for months. And this friend of my dad's, he's like an uncle to me. He helped me out and he gave me a purpose. He told me that what I was good at over there could be useful here. And it's a job. you know? The money's good. And these people I take out, like, they're bad people, you know, like they're pieces of shit. But lately, you know, I've, like, I'm not sleeping, and that depressed feeling's back, you know? Like I know there's more to me than that. But maybe, I don't know, maybe there's not. Maybe this is all I'm good at. I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, I think my sister called me after that, and she was like, wow, that's like, yeah, it's very personal. That's kind of your, you know, that like kind of anxiety, wanting to be kind of accepted. The way he's at in that scene, look, if you had showed up to my high school, you'd be like, oh, he seems fine. You know, it's kind of what you're saying at SNL. But I'm an actor. You know, you're good at hiding stuff and being like, everything's fine, everything's great. But underneath is just a lot of turmoil. And getting to kind of write about it and play it in that way was great. The interesting thing on a side note about that scene is that Henry Winkler had to leave when we shot that. So I'm doing that whole monologue to like a mark on a sandbag that's on a C-stand because Henry left. He had to leave. It's not his own. It's not his fault. But I did that to that. And I was like, all right. And we did four takes of it. And I was like, all right, well, I guess everybody go home now.
Well, once you do that scene, did you feel better?
Yeah. Well, it happened a little bit in Skeleton Twins, but it is nice where you feel like, this is like an artistic endeavor in the same way writing and directing is, where you are having some personal expression in it. Even though you're playing a killer, or in Skeleton Twins, it's a suicidal person who feels like he's a failure. It doesn't matter. You know, there's something that there's a Venn diagram there between who the character is and you are. And you want to play that. You know what the big thing was too, was being able to have the confidence to go, I'm a good writer and I think I can direct. And that was always the thing. I had zero confidence even saying out loud, but it was nice being able to have a table read and go, this stuff is working. And again, it's not just me. It's Alec Berg, Duffy Boudreau, Liz Sarnoff.
Takes a village.
It takes a village, a lot of people. But getting that confidence was very new. That was helpful.
Just being able to say that.
Yeah, just being able to say, without mumbling it to myself, like, oh, I'm a writer or a director, you know. I wasn't even comfortable saying I was an actor until I was doing press for Skeleton Twins. I was like, oh, I do sketch comedy. So it's not some false modesty thing or whatever. I mean, I do think sometimes I do think it's an Oklahoma thing. I do think like where I grew up, saying I want this, you know, it's not attractive.
Right. Outside of ordering something on the menu.
Exactly. Outside of, yes, buying a car. It's really disturbing. So I've always kind of not been that way. And it's been helpful in this endeavor.
It's funny, as you were saying that, finally recognizing that, oh, I can direct. I can be the thing that 17-year-old you, on the heels of your grandfather passing, that you are that thing that you wanted to become as a teenager.
Yeah, it's really nice. I mean, it is a thing where something that's very important to me to not lose track of that, what I learned or got from his life and his death.
That time is precious.
Yeah. That's like something I go back to a lot.
But that realization that time is short.
Yeah.
It seems like that story Del Close used to always tell you, a Second City staple.
Yeah. He didn't tell me this. I read it, but it is a thing that really stuck with me, of the skydiver who jumps out of a plane and dances in the sky and pulls a parachute and goes to the ground. And this one sky dancer was doing their sky dance, pulled a parachute, and it malfunctioned. So the sky dancer knew that they were going to die, and the sky dancer continued to dance all the way to the ground. And it's kind of like, well, that's what we're doing, you know? We're all headed towards the ground, you know? And it's just kind of depends on what you choose to do.
It seems like what you've chosen to do is basically try to recapture that feeling that you saw your mother have in your childhood watching The Hunchback of Notre Dame.
Yeah, 100%. Where she saw Charles Lawton swing down, save Reno Sullivan, and she went, oh, like that. And I was like, oh, wow. Yeah, it gave me chills because she just was so shocked by that, you know, or just so moved by it. That's the stuff that, you live for. It's my favorite thing. It's like I love watching movies with people who are emotive. I'm dear, dear friend is Darcy Carden, and she's like that. You know, she'll watch the episodes of this show, and her reactions are just like, oh, my God. And, yeah, my mother, you know, was that way, you know.
Do movies still produce the same in you?
Yeah, yeah, that's the best feeling ever. And now that I have children, it's like watching it with them and us, whether it's good or bad, having those feelings. But I was watching Knights of Cabiria, and the ending of that movie just knocks me out, man. And it tricks me every time, too. I don't want to give it away for people, but I just was so moved and just completely. There's also a scene in it where she goes to a hypnotist and she's this thing and they hypnotize her. And it's just beautiful. I mean, and just what it says. And again, George Saunders, you know, we've talked about this too. You can get really, you know, theoretical about it or whatever. But at the end of it, it's all just emotion and it's all intuitive. And there's just something that I can't even describe it to you of why the end of Knights of Cabiria lays me out. But it does. Why the end of Akiru or Coen Brothers, Serious Man, why the end of that movie just floors me. And I remember the lights came up and I just sat there, you know, I mean, it's just amazing.
Well, that feeling you're describing, it's one I've had many times watching Barry.
Oh, thank you.
And I'm just glad that 17-year-old who really thought it was a good idea to go out of state for community college.
Oh, Bill.
I'm glad you made it around.
Thanks, pal. I really appreciate it, man.
Bill Hader, lovely to meet you.
Lovely to meet you, pal.
That was a really great interview.
We did it.
That was a really fun interview.
Was that okay?
Oh, my God, are you kidding?
And that's our show. Special thanks to Matt Labov, HBO, and of course, Bill Hader. New episodes of Barry air every Sunday night on HBO. To learn more about Bill and his work, visit our show notes at talkeasypod.com. If you enjoyed today's episode, I'd recommend our talks with George Saunders, Norman Lear, Carol Burnett, Larry Wilmore, Nick Offerman, Laura Dern, Ted Danson, Alan Alda, Pam Grier, and Steven Soderbergh. To hear those and more Pushkin podcasts, listen on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you like to listen. You can also follow us on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram at TalkEasyPod. Be sure to leave us a review on Apple, Spotify, wherever you listen. Doing so is still the best way for new listeners to find the show. If you want to purchase one of our Talk Easy mugs, they come in cream or navy, or our vinyl record with Fran Lebowitz, you can do so at talkeasypod.com/shop. As always, this show would not be possible without our incredible team. Talk Easy is produced by Caroline Reebok. Our executive producer is Janixa Bravo. Our associate producer is Caitlin Dryden. Today's talk was edited by Clarice Guevara and mixed by Andrew Vastola. It was taped at KCRW in Santa Monica. Music by Dylan Peck. Illustrations by Krisha Shenoy. Photographs by Jenna Jones. Video and graphics by Ian Chang, Derek Gaberzak, Ian Jones, Ethan Seneca, and Layla Register. Special thanks to Patrice Lee, Kaylin Ung, and Shiloh Fagan. I'd also like to thank the team at Pushkin Industries, Justin Richmond, Julia Barton, John Schnars, Carrie Brody, David Glover, Heather Fain, Mia LaBelle, Eric Sandler, Nicole Morano, Maggie Taylor, Morgan Ratner, Maya Koenig, Carly Migliori, Jason Gambrell, Malcolm Gladwell, and Jacob Weisberg. I'm Sam Fragoso. Thank you for listening to Talk Easy. I'll see you back here next Sunday for a Mother's Day special with the one and only Minnie Driver. Until then, stay safe and so long.
I'm David Remnick, and each week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, my colleagues and I unpack what's happening in a very complicated world. You'll hear from the New Yorker's award-winning reporters and thinkers, Jelani Cobb on race and justice, Jill Lepore on American history, Vincent Cunningham and Gia Tolentino on culture, Bill McKibben on climate change, and many more. To get the context behind events in the news, listen to the New Yorker Radio Hour wherever you get your podcasts.